Hi, I'm Mark. I'm a real alcoholic. And thanks very much for letting me share with you tonight. I think some of you were here last week, right? Yeah? Yeah. And we talked about the Dr. Silkworth's observations on the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And a lot of times, you know, in the big book, after the doctor's opinion comes Bill's story, because Bill's story is a classic case example of the illness that Dr. Silkworth has described. And it shows the patient, Bill Wilson, who has the allergy, has the obsession of the mind, and he tells his story on how he got very, very sick and how he got better. And we usually mimic that when we do the book study. We do the doctor's opinion, and then we tell Bill's story, and we do a case example of the disease process of alcoholism that we have just described to you in the doctor's opinion. But Don decided that I should tell my story tonight, and I usually do as Don tells me, because he's twice my size. And so I'm going to tell you my story and see if you can find the allergy and the obsession of the mind. And I'll try to tell you how sick I got and how I think I got better. So I'm here tonight and I'm vertical. My socks match. My breakfast stayed down. I got no warrants. And so I think I'm better, you know. Again, I just want to say, as I usually do, it's really nice, special, to be welcomed somewhere. That was not always the case for me. As you'll hear, I got sober in New York City and Brooklyn, not from there originally, from Ohio, but that's where I hit my bottom, in Brooklyn. And even in Brooklyn, they would cross the street, so they would not have to pass me on the sidewalk. And there was not a single establishment anywhere in that borough, anywhere I went, for towards the end of my drinking, I was allowed to enter. They would 86 me from the doorway. Very undeserved, of course. So it's really nice to be welcome somewhere. And the only reason I am welcome here tonight is because of those 12 steps in that book and Alcoholics Anonymous. I also like to say that, you know, if you hear anything you like tonight, that's from your higher power. If you hear something you don't like, that's from me. And I'm a sick alcoholic, and you're just going to have to deal with that as best you can. Don't throw things. Don't get violent. Talk to your sponsor. Work the steps around it. But, you know, consider the source, right? Okay, so like I said, I'm Mark, and I'm a real alcoholic. And, you know, there's all kinds of discussions about the onset of alcoholism and how it develops in people, and everyone's story is a little different. Me, I was an alcoholic right out of the box, you know. When I was a little kid, we used to play, you know, cowboys and Indians and war and tag and all stuff like that. But one of my favorite games was bar. I liked that game. I really liked that game. And what we'd do is, you know, we'd get around the kitchen table when our parents weren't around, and we'd get ginger ale and we'd pour it in shot glasses, and we'd slam ginger ale, and then we'd stumble around the kitchen like we were drunk. And my buddies would always get bored of it. You know, I wanted to play it all afternoon. And, you know, they'd get bored after a couple shots, you know, but I'd want to keep doing that. I got my first set of stitches as a four-year-old. I was imitating a drunk. I had my hands in my pockets, and I was staggering all over the floor, and I slipped on the linoleum, fell on my chin, and cut my chin open. I think I was even younger than that when I had my first drink. It was kind of prophetic, really. I think I had the flu or something, one of those childhood diseases, and I had a cough. And they gave me this cherry-flavored stuff for my cold. And I felt like crap. And they gave me this stuff. It tasted kind of lousy, but it burned all the way down. And then the fire kind of went out in my arms and my legs, and I felt really wonderful, and all the bad feelings went away. And later that evening, after my parents went to sleep, I pushed the chair up to the refrigerator. I climbed up on the chair. I got that bottle, and I drank the whole thing. And the next morning, my mother said to me, "Mark, that's not candy." And I thought, yeah, I got away with that. You know, I knew it wasn't candy. I love the way that's, whatever that was in there made me feel. And I found out pretty quickly it was alcohol. And I started chasing it from that time on. And so whenever I could get a hold of it, I drank it. As much as I could get away with, as much as I could get my hands on. When we were out in the streets as a little kid, if I could get my hands on it, I'd drink as much as I could. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, in a Polish, Irish, Italian neighborhood. There's a bar on every corner. And usually in that neighborhood, you got on the streets by the time you were 5, and I was in the gang by the time I was 6. Not only was I an alcoholic out of the box, but I walked to the dark side right away. Doing bad things and getting in trouble appealed to me from the time I was just a little kid. And I don't know about you, but it seems to me there's some relationship there. But anyway, I was in the gang right away. And, you know, those were the days of engineer boots and real clean, believe it or not, ducktail haircuts. Not anymore. Leather jackets, switch knives, zip guns, chains, gang fights, stealing cars, breaking and entering. As 8 and 9 year olds, we were the breaking and entering experts because we could crawl through skylights and down interior ducts that the adults couldn't get down inside. And we could get down inside, open the building up, and rob it, you know. So it was a real wholesome, fine childhood that I had growing up. But a pretty common story for a kid in an urban environment with my mindset. Fortunately for me, I had very loving parents. And just a quick aside on some of this, you know, genetic and family stuff about alcoholism. You know, a lot of us, we come from families, everybody's alcoholic, you know. Brother's alcoholic, father's alcoholic, mother's alcoholic, grandparents alcoholic. Some of us come from families, we're the only one. My father, God rest his soul, one of the most wonderful guys I've ever known. He died of this disease when he was 53. His father died of it when he was 51, also a wonderful guy. In my father's family, there were 11 children, 6 of who lived. And you can imagine how many uncles and aunts and cousins that produced. Out of the whole side of my father's family, me, my dad, and my grandpa are the only alcoholics. There's probably 100 offspring now, and no one else is alcoholic. So if you think they've got the genetics of this disease figured out, forget about it. They don't have a clue. But anyway, back to the main story. I had very kind and loving parents, and they realized that, you know, being a gang member wasn't going to be too good for my future. And so they intervened in my life. And they sent me basically they sent me to a reform school that you pay to go to. They call those military schools. And they sent me off there. I think I was about 11 years old. And it was a pretty tough school. It was in the middle of nowhere. They occupied your every breathing moment. They had exquisite methods of psychological torture. They never put a hand on you, but they had developed it. They specialized in kids who liked to get in trouble and kids who didn't want to learn. And they really had learned how to break through to us. And they were able to reach about 90% of us. And all of us, most of us kids were from Detroit, Cleveland, Chicago, Buffalo, Great Lakes region. You know, we didn't give a crap about anything. We were all troublemakers. And they had this combination of scholastic, physical, and spiritual program that actually broke through to us, and most of us did pretty well. If it hadn't been for that school, I there's no question in my mind, I would be either dead or in prison for the rest of my life. So I guess that's the first time something greater than me intervened in my life. So I did pretty well in that school. But whenever I got out on pass, or whenever I came home for the holidays, I would drink, I would get drunk, and I would raise hell. And a pattern started to form right then and there. There was a lot of spirituality there. There was a lot of that stuff that I just kept ignoring that. I kept ignoring that. And the pattern I formed at this point was that if you can perform, if you can accomplish, if you can do okay, then when you're free, when you're off duty, you're allowed to do anything you want as long as you can get away with it. And I thought that was pretty smart, you know. So I'd come home, you know, for a couple months in the summertime, and my buddies and I would go out and drink all the time. And the summer before I went off to college, even though I had 5 years at that good school, and I was working that summer, I was working in the steel mills, I was drunk every night. But, you know, hey, you're 17, you know, you're made out of steel, and you can drink until 4 or 5 in the morning, come home, shower, shave, sleep for half an hour, get up and go and work. And then you can come home, eat supper, go out, drink all night, just get up and do it again. You know, and I thought, I didn't see anything wrong with doing that. I didn't see any problems with drinking like that. I just, you know, thought it was obviously hard evidence that I was tough, that I was smart, and that I could handle it. Other people couldn't handle it. That was their problem. That was my attitude. And so then off I went to college. And then this pattern really settled in. Obviously I took a lot of science courses because I wanted to go to medical school. The pre-med curriculum was pretty demanding. Plus I had to work all through college. So I had a job. I was carrying a full load. And I had a lot of science courses. And the last shreds of any spirituality I had kind of went out the window at that point. Everything was about, you know, knowledge and knowing and accomplishing and doing, and, you know, I had the answers and I knew where I was going and I didn't need any of this God stuff and I didn't need any of this going to church or reading any kind of inspirational books. You know, I just needed the scientists and the philosophers. And I, you know, and that's where spirituality and I really parted company. So I would work hard, study hard all week, Friday night, go out and just get totally wasted. usually manage it in those days, you know, maybe 12 to 20 beers and anywhere from a pint to a fifth of whiskey, which I didn't think that was, you know, that was just like maintenance to me. And then I'd get up early Saturday morning, go to my job, get that squared away, and I'd study all weekend. And then the week would start, and I'd go to class, study every night till 2, 3 in the morning. And so that was it, you know, work and drink, work and drink. And this was to become my pattern, workaholic as well as alcoholic, as well as a drug addict. And I thought this was pretty cool. And I noticed that a lot of the kids I was going to school with could not do what I was doing, and I was pretty proud of the fact that I could do this and they couldn't. I had no inkling that I had all the signs and symptoms of alcoholism and addiction, and that I was on, you know, that I was already put my feet on the doom loop. You know, I thought I was living on the edge and pretty cool. And as my first sponsor told me, yeah, Mark, you were living on the edge of a toilet that was broken and hadn't been flushed in a week. Yeah, that's some of that Brooklyn tough love. We'll get into that in a little while. But, and so there I went. And towards the end of my college days, I discovered one of Mommy's little helpers for studying called amphetamine. And boy, I really, really liked that stuff, you know. I mean, now I had an afterburner, you know. Instead of, you know, now I could, geez, wow, I could just drink all night. And I could roll in, take a shower, shave, drop some amphetamines, and go on about my day, and go on about the next day. And all I had to do was kind of arrange the crash time, you know. And I thought, wow, better living through chemistry. This is just great, you know. I thought, this is really cool, you know. And I thought I was just, boy, I just thought, cat's meow. I got into medical school, and it was a lot of work. It was, you know, there's a lot of work. And again, I worked on and off, but it was the same pattern again. Study late into the night, get up early in the morning, go to class all day, stay up late, and then Friday would come, go out and get wasted, you know, and that pattern went on. Started getting in a little trouble, you know, started having blackouts, starting not remembering what was going on. Started getting, shouldn't say getting in fights, started losing fights. And, you know, and then not doing so well with my relationships with other people. A lot more lying, a lot more dishonesty. I got married, and she caught on pretty fast, and that ended, and I didn't do too much damage that time. And then off I went for more, you know, for more training. And the drinking was, you know, was just nonstop. I mean, we couldn't drink on duty. We didn't drink on duty very much. You know, that just didn't work out very well. You had to be up 36 hours straight. Drinking Jack Daniels while you were working, that just didn't work out very well. So most of us, we didn't do that. And you couldn't be taking amphetamines all that time either. You know, you're be in the operating room, your hands would shake so bad they'd throw you out of there. So you had to kind of detox and go to work. And I did that as well. But, you know, I got through that, and I was kind of at loose ends on what to do, and I was, you know, working sort of part-time in my field, raising a lot of hell. And by this time, you know, I had the sports car and the race horse, and I was going to blind, you know, I was going to after hours places and blind pigs with three guns, and you know, I was just having a good old time. And I got this really incredible opportunity came up. This was back in the early 70s. Now, I'm, you know, an emergency doctor. And back then, there really was no specialty of emergency medicine. There were no paramedics. There was no trauma system. It just didn't exist. And I'd had training in the field, which at that time was fairly unusual. And so this big, responsible hospital in this big city in Ohio offered me the directorship of their ER, and they gave me, like, carte blanche to build this place from the ground up, which, you know, was quite an opportunity. And my immediate boss was this prince of a guy who was very, very understanding, very knowledgeable, but he was pretty much of a straight arrow. And his boss was a nun. Here I am, three guns, sports car, race horse, you know, nine girlfriends. I mean, you know, this isn't going to work out. So, I mean, this is not a fit, okay? And whether I'm, you know, competent as a doctor or not, I mean, I can't, you know, show up at the hospital banquet with my three girlfriends in their hot pants wearing two guns and half drunk. You know, this is just not going to go over very well with these people who have put all this responsibility on my shoulders. So I said to myself, well, okay, I really want this, so no problem. I can clean up, you know, I can clean up my act, I can straighten out, and I'll put away the amphetamine. I'll sell the racehorse. I'll put the guns away. I'll sell the sports car, and I'm going to settle down, and I'm going to do this job. And that's when I entered that like controlled drinking phase that everyone talks about. So I did that, you know, sold the racehorse, the sports car, put away the guns. You know, tried not to drink, you know, two bottles of Jack Daniels when I was off duty. And it seemed to work. I met this really nice girl, and I thought, well, maybe that would be better if I had a wife, you know. So I married her, God forgive me. And, you know, we had a white picket fence, a nice little house, and little kids, and I was, you know, trying not to drink a fifth of Jack Daniels a night. And I got in some trouble, you know. I had a couple auto accidents. I had some incidents and a blackout. You know, I was, you know, one night I was running around the house ripping all the drapes off the windows and didn't remember doing it. Stuff, you know, just little stuff like that. You know, and the wife saying, geez, you know, you think it's the whiskey, Mark? And yeah, probably. So I said, okay, well, I'm going to put that Jack Daniels away because that's the problem. I mean, I'm in control here. And there's something in that Jack Daniels that's not on the label. And that's what's causing the problem, okay? I got this figured out, see? It's not the alcohol. It can't be the alcohol. I'm too good at drinking. I mean, you know. So I switched to white wine. Yeah. Sound familiar? Yeah. Yeah, you know, Carlo Ponte, you know, those half, you know. Yeah, the White Mountain, something or other. Yeah. The half-gallon ones, you know, the plastic ones. So you'd knock them over, yeah, right. So I switched to white wine, you know, a half to a gallon a night, you know. And that worked for a while. And then I had some more blackouts, I said, well, I know what I'll do. I'll switch to beer. You know, in the big book, you can read Dr. Bob's beer experiment. Well, this is Dr. Mark's beer experiment. I hate beer. That panther piss, that crap, I hate that stuff. You got to drink so much of that to get loaded. I mean, so what I had to do when I switched to beer was I had to keep some beer glasses in the freezer along with the beer, okay? It's like, I hate that stuff. But if you have a really ice glass in an almost frozen can of beer, you can pour it so there's no head on it, and it's totally flat and yellow, and then you can slam it like a shot. Bam! And one of those every 5 minutes for a couple hours, and you can at least get a little buzzing in your ears, you know, and it keeps you from shaking so bad. But I lasted about 2 months on that, and it was back to Carlo Ponte. And, you know, I was just drinking a maybe half gallon to gallon. Well, maybe a half gallon during the week, and then a gallon a night on the weekends, or maybe it was more than that sometimes. Anyway, and I think, you know, everything's fine. Okay, I'm doing great here. My job's going great, I think. My family's happy, I think. You know, I don't realize that they're going like, Jesus, you know. And we, at the hospital, we changed our hours. You know, we used to work like 9 or 10 hour shifts. We changed them to 13 hours so we could have more time off, which, you know, for a drunkard, that's... Give me that time off so I can drink, you know. And I was getting towards the end of my shift one night. I had a seizure on duty. Well, yeah, I mean, you're drinking a gallon of wine a night. You know, you can only go, you know, if you're susceptible at all, you can't go that long. You go into withdrawal and boom, some of us will have a seizure. So I had a seizure on duty. And I thought no one knew why, you know. And they put me through a big, you know, full evaluation, CAT scan, neurologist. And I told them all this bullshit about boxing golden gloves as a kid and all these head injuries that, I mean, I got hit in the head a lot, but so what, you know. I told them all this crap. I'm sure they didn't believe a word I said, you know, but they went, yeah, Mark, yeah, you know. But by the way, Mark, we suggest that you don't drink. And I said, okay, fine, you know. And then I had a couple more seizures, not on duty, but I had a couple more seizures at home. And started having a lot of seizures. And they kind of called me in and sort of told me, you know, look, we don't think you should be drinking. And we think you have a problem with drinking, and if you drink anymore, you know, things aren't going to work out for you. And I said, okay, I'll go see a psychiatrist, you know. And I went in there and paid him, you know, whatever he charged, $125 an hour. And you go in there and pay him that kind of money, and you just lie to him the whole hour, you know. You know, and he kept trying to get me to go to AA, and I didn't want any part of AA, you know. I don't need that shit, you know, and yeah, okay. And so one night, you know, I was getting ready to go to the hospital, and I'd been drinking, and I got in an auto accident on the way to the hospital, and I told the guy, yeah, don't worry about it, it's nothing, you know. He said, hey, man, my car. I said, I got to go to the hospital, I'll see you later, and I just drove away, you know. I got to the hospital, right in front of the hospital, Cincinnati's finest, arrest me, you know, the red lights and everything, put me in handcuffs, and take me away. So they suspended me for that, yeah. They said, Mark, you know, I think we can struggle along without you here. You're suspended, and that's it. And I was really indignant about that. You know, I said, I just had a little accident. I had a couple drinks. What's the big deal? I mean, this is nothing. You know, look at all I've done for you. Look at, I've built your operation from the ground up. You know, I got you hooked in with the university. I did this, I did that. And they said, yeah, well, we're very grateful, but. And I actually put all that bullshit in a letter, which I still have a copy of. I get out, and when I'm feeling pretty cool and smart, I get out and read it. Brings me back down real fast, you know. God, what an asshole, you know. But anyway, and then, of course, by this time I've got like 3 or 4 or 5 DUIs, criminal trespass, assault and battery of police officer, in addition to this accident. I got all these, quote, legal issues going on, and now I'm suspended. So I get this brilliant idea that I'm going to go somewhere else. And I talk to my lawyer, and I says, look, just get a lot of continuances. Stretch this out as long as you can. And I gave him the money, and I skipped town. Skipped jump bail and took off. And I decided to go to New York City, where I was going to revolutionize the emergency care. And I was going to become one of the most famous doctors in New York City. Yeah, you know, our life is the only normal one. And so I got to New York City, and I said, well, God, I really worked my ass off back there in Cincinnati, and through residency, and all through medical school, and all I've been doing is working and working and working, and these people are so ungrateful. I really deserve a break before I really get started here. I'm going to take some time off, I said. Relax a little bit. And I finally started to do what I'd always wanted to do, and that's to drink around the clock, day in and day out, with no end in sight. And so I started to do that. And my disease took off with a vengeance. I didn't know it. See, I was headed for the waterfall. You know, things were still pretty smooth. I mean, you know, I was going out, getting whiskey, you know, booze, running all over New York, you know, getting some drugs, having a good time. But I was headed for the waterfall. And it wasn't long. It was maybe a couple months of doing this. And there was no stopping. There was no stopping. And no more, you know, no more getting stimulants or getting some, you know, narcotics or stuff to cool off with. Because, you know, at that time in New York, you had to have a couple of smarts to cop drugs. And I was always so screwed up. Every time I tried to do that, they just laugh at me, knock me down, and take my money, you know. So, and then, you know, and then pretty soon, you know, like the liquor store, they'd just say, I'd walk in, hey, man, you know, and they'd, man, they'd say, get out of here, get out of here. Go on, get out. The bars, nope. They'd say, nope. They'd start 86 in me. So the only place I could even get in would be the little delis that sold, you know, Thunderbird and Mad Dog. And I'd come in and they'd, you know, put it on the counter and they'd, you know, throw me out. It was about 4 months that took to have for that to happen. And so then it really started. Just drinking fortified wine, they call it. The Thunderbird Mad Dog was usually what I could get my hands on. And then there it was. And I was in a place I like to call the land of the living dead. And there was no day, there was no night, there was nobody there. It was just this long gray tube filled with demons and alcohol. And I don't know if you want to get to this place, but I mean, I got to the place where I would look at that bottle of Thunderbird in my hand, and I would say, God, here comes the jail, here comes the hospital, here comes all kinds of pain and demons and and I couldn't. I had to put it down. If it came up, I just have to get another bottle and nurse it down till I could get it. I had to get it down, and that's where that took me. Took me to the hospital. Took me to jail. You know, I wake up in the street, and a couple times tied to the bed at the county hospital in DTs. And it just went on and on like that. Just went on and on like that. So I was tied to the bed at the county hospital again in Brooklyn. And they kind of halfway dried me out. And I got out of there. And I think it was in the morning. I'd probably been out of the hospital a day or so. And, you know, I mean, what are you going to go have a drink, right? I mean, you know, I got out of the hospital. I'm okay, right? So I think it was in the morning, about 10 o'clock, maybe 11 o'clock in the morning. I walked into one of my, quote, favorite bars in Brooklyn. This is one of the few places that they wouldn't 86 me out of. And I don't know how this happened. But I walked into that bar, and I saw it for the first time. My feet stuck to the floor as I walked to the bar. There was a guy in the back, passed out face down in front of an empty bottle of vodka. The window pane was broken, and a little ray of sunlight was coming through, and you could just see the filth in the air. And I turned to the bartender. And he was wearing like this white ruffled shirt with this little tie. And he was real pale. He looked like Dracula. You know, he looked like he just got out of a coffin. And he had the jitters. And I had the jitters. You know. And I said, give me a double vodka, no ice. And he says, yeah. And he took the bottle was going clink, 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 clink on the glass. And I had to lean down on the bar and slurp that vodka up like a dog drinking out of a bowl. And I sat up from drinking that drink. And I said, God, I just had a drink. Now it's going to all start over again. I just got out of the hospital. Now I've had a drink. Here comes the hospital, the jail, the fights, the seizures, it's all going to start over. I'm going to go to AA. Where did that come from? I guess that's in this program is what they call a moment of clarity. I didn't have another drink. Don't ask me why. I don't know. I left that bar and I found an AA meeting. Later that day. And, you know, in New York, in Brooklyn, it's simple. You go walk up to any drunk on the street and ask them where AA is, they'll tell you that. You know? I had a hard time finding it because I couldn't remember where I was. But I finally found it, and it was in a church. I thought, this is, I mean, I was, you know, it was in a church. I was afraid to go in there. I thought the roof was going to fall on me. So I went in there. I walked in. They said, hi, how are you doing? And I thought, oh, boy, I'm doing great. And who are you, you know? And they gave me half a cup of coffee because I was shaking so bad. And they gave me a cookie. I thought, Jesus, a black kind of cookie off the... This really sucks, you know. What have I done, you know? And then I sat down and there were all these nice people, you know, and these girls were knitting, you know, and everything. I said, Jesus Christ, this is, oh God, I'll just get through this, you know. And this girl got up, she told her story. It was this nice little story, you know. was all done, and then people shared, and I thought, God. Then it was over. The meeting was over, and I said, that's it. I'm doomed. He said, I'm doomed. If this is AA, man, I'm going down, man. I'm going to bite the dust. Yes. Fuck this, you know. So I walk out of there, you know, well, you know. And I'm walking down the street. I'm walking down the street. And wait a minute. I don't want to drink. Now, I want to drink bad, you know, bad. But not that, like, I got to, you know. No. What the hell? It's okay. I'll go back tomorrow. I didn't drink. I went back. This guy got up and told his story. He made my story sound like Bambi. And I said, wait a minute. I got it. This is New York City. They got a lot of unemployed actors here. They're bringing this guy in here to scare me. He's an actor. He's a liar. They're trying to scare me. I mean, I was pretty fried. I was pretty fried by this time. You know, I mean, I couldn't read. I couldn't add and subtract. You know, I would not tell you the truth about any. If you asked me my name, I would lie. I couldn't tell time, so I wouldn't lie, you know. And that's what I thought. So I left there. I said, a bunch of actors are trying to scare me, but I didn't want to drink. I wanted to drink bad. I mean, it was early summer, and I walked down the street past the bars. You know, they have those vents that come out that blow out that foul, stinky beer smell, that, you know. And I would smell that, and the saliva would run out of my mouth down my shirt. Yeah, like Pavlov's dog, you know. Ring the bell, you know, yeah. But I didn't act on it. And I went back the next night, and this other guy got up. He told his story, made that first guy's story sound like Bambi. And I said, Jesus Christ, they drink like me. And when they drink, they do what I do. And they ain't drinking. Something's going on here. I don't know what's going on here. But something is going on here. And I start coming back. And, I mean, I could say, I had a lot, you know, not, you know, ready for the Napa yet, but I had a lot of brain damage. You know, they were talking about a higher power. I thought they were talking about the electric company. And then they were talking about working steps, and I could not figure out how going up and down steps was going to help me not drink. And then they said I had to have a sponsor, and I thought I was going to be on TV. And I didn't want to be on TV. I mean, I had, read the big book. Are you kidding, man? You know, but I didn't want to drink. I mean, I want to drink bad, but I was coming back. And they kept, you know, and, oh, God? I couldn't even say that word. If I tried to say the word God at that time, it would come out like a demon inside of me wouldn't, you know. I couldn't say it. Now, I didn't know what, you know, but they didn't bother me. They always let me in. They let me sit down. They didn't tell me to put my hand. They just left me alone. They welcomed me. That was it. 'Cause they you know, they'd seen a lot of people like me. I was no big deal to them. And I don't know, it must have been about, I was 2 or 3 weeks maybe into the, just going to AA. That's all I could do. And, you know, I mean, I've been scared a lot of times. And if you guys have been out there, you know, I mean, how many times should we be dead? 1,000? You know, I had people shoot at me and stab me and all kinds of stuff. Physical death was like, blah, big deal, you know. I mean, I've been scared, but this night, I was asleep. And I woke up, and I was just covered in sweat. And there was something in the room. I could feel it. I mean, I'm like 3 weeks now. I mean, I had DTs, I had all the hallucinations, the seizures, all that crap. I've been there. I've been in, God, you know, you get a Golden Globe for detoxing more than 25,000 times or something. I had been there, man, you know. This was not detox. There was something in the room. And I looked up on the wall. There was a black angel of death hanging there with a big red head. And you could see it breathe. And did you ever see the movie Ghost? Well, that movie wasn't made when this happened. Those little brown things that run around the room, you know, that come for you, they were running around on the floor. And it was the first time in my life I was ever terrified. Because I was in the presence of unspeakable evil, and it had come for me. Not my physical flesh. It had come for me. And I said, I don't know what this higher power crap is, this God stuff or whatever it is that they're talking about in AA, but if it's not real, I'm doomed. Because I am going to go to a place that is worse than I could ever imagine. And I knew it. So I went, you know, I went back, as soon as the sun came up, I went to the first meeting I could find, and, you know, I started talking to people and asking for help, I said, I give up, I surrender, I'm done, I said, whatever you guys want me to do, I'll do, you know, you want me, I'll do anything. And then I got a guy and start working with him. And about 2 weeks later, roughly, it, you know, time still I couldn't, you know, I don't have a good grip on the time. I was standing on a roof in Brooklyn. You know, most of the places you live there, you don't have a balcony. You just go out on the roof. And Brooklyn, you know, it's real beautiful. One black roof after another with all these dirty brick buildings. You know, it's really scenic and lovely. So I was out on this roof. It was towards evening. And I looked and there was this tree coming up between the buildings. Now, I've seen a lot of trees. I've looked at a lot of trees. But I've never really, really seen one before this moment. And I looked at this tree and it was gorgeous. It was strong. Powerful, it had come up between these buildings. All the leaves were full and identical. And I said, that's what they're talking about in those rooms. That's what AA means by a higher power. The power that made this tree come up between these buildings in this dirty, desolate place, that's the power that can save me. That's the power that can keep me going to that awful place that I had a glimpse of. And at that point on, I really dove into the program. Okay? You take a break? All right.